Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting.
Yeah.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love. Africa.
That's right. That's right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we've been trying to do it right, but some people didn't get that memo. So we're going to try to make it plain to them and connect the dots as we usually do. Talk about all the battlefronts across this country and actually across the globe of people who are fighting against racism, fighting against patriarchy, homophobia, Islamophobia. But we use so many battlefronts to do that. We use the campuses, we use the streets, we use the legislative halls. And so there are many battles, and sometimes people feel isolated, that they're the only ones doing this, they're the only ones going through this. But now the oppression and repression is so, made so global now based on you all's president, that we have there's no pretense of what's going on now. So we're glad that you're here. I like to try to always give you the reminders of important things, because they may not always be on the front page of the news. There's still genocide going on in Gaza. Although I do have some important news, to some progress. You know, the crossing at Rafah has been closed for most of these 2 years. That has now been open, and that has allowed the Palestinians to get out, get some services, get some medical attention. So that was an improvement, and it's a progress. And so we'll see what else is going to happen. But, you know, that's progress, but we still have a pathological liar in the White House. We still have a 34-count felon. Convicted felon in the White House. And we are getting closer and closer to being able to say he might even be part of the pedophile ring of Jeffrey Epstein. But what we do know, because we've looked at his past, is that he is supporting pedophiles. There is a Missouri state legislature who said GOP stands for Guardian of Pedophiles. And that's appropriate. GOP, Guardians of Pedophiles, but we could see the extensive nature of this. Other thing I want to say about the Epstein files, because they have been so strategic and intentional about the release of the files and when they're released. And so at a certain point, people will start to get fatigue about the files. And then they would say, there's more important things than that. But that, you know, it's difficult to start ranking like what's important, because there are a bunch of women who've been victimized who still have not gotten their justice, and any of us who've been doing the work around rape and sexual assault knows that this is not finished. And so the fact that they say, okay, y'all want them, y'all passed the little act, y'all want all these files, we're gonna give them to you. And so they gave them to us sometimes with unredacted information and photos of some of the victims, which is re-traumatizing them. And interestingly enough, some of the real people that need to be outed have had their identities redacted. And so we know these are games that are being played, and we're going to see through them, and we're going to call it for what it is. But we got some deviants in the White House. Some people that have no compassion, not at all. I know Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett said, what we do have in the White House is not a president, but a national emergency wearing a red tie. And I would say an international emergency wearing a red tie. And also a reminder, Jasmine Crockett is from St. Louis. She's on loan to Texas until we want her back, so don't get too comfortable with that. But she certainly has been a mouthpiece for the people and calling it the way it is. So we're going to, the other thing I want to say is, like, for abolitionists and been doing work around the death penalty, we were ecstatic last week when Tommy Lee Walker was exonerated. This was a black teen that was accused of raping and killing a white woman in Texas. The problem with that is that little brother was executed in 1956. So too little, too late. But this is why we have to oppose the death penalty, because when they start going, they don't care who it is, what the situation is. That brother wasn't even around this woman. And there were people who were able to say that, but they really don't care. But, you know, here he is exonerated. His life is gone. His only son, who was just born at the time of the event. In fact, the night of the event, his mother went into labor and had him. So, you know, this is the reason why we have to say abolish the death penalty, abolish the prison industrial complex, because they are corrupt and will never be just for black folks and poor folks and working folks. So we're gonna get started, because this is Black Commentator Wednesday, and so we have some of our contributors to Black Commentator. And because some of you all said that I didn't give enough information about what Black Commentator is, David Love is our editor, and so I'm gonna let him talk a little bit about Black Commentator and all our roles in that endeavor. David.
Well, thank you so much again for bringing us all together. It's a pleasure to be here. And for those who don't know, Black Commentator is a weekly commentary dedicated to issues of economic justice, social justice, and peace affecting African Americans and the African world. The website has been around since 2002. I have been writing for Black Commentator for, I guess, close to 20 years now. I really appreciate being in community with you, Jamala, and Reverend Irene and Elwood, particularly now when media, particularly Black media, are under assault. I can't think of a more crucial time for us to be able to express our views on issues affecting our community. That's why I think resources like Black Commentator are so valuable. And I encourage people to go to the website, blackcommentator.com, to check us out, see what we're writing, expert opinions and expert analysis. If you want to get in touch with us, the email is publisher@blackcommentator.com. If you have comments or want to contribute a piece. So, hey, it's once again, it's great to be here.
So I'm going to bring in Elwood Watson and Reverend Irene Monroe, because they are also contributors. And one of the things I find fascinating is sometimes we write about the same thing, even though we haven't communicated, because those are the things that are going on in the world and probably are heavy on our heart and mind. And almost sometimes it looks like we could write each other's stuff. So, and I think the latitude that we have from our publisher, we pretty much can say what we want to say. And we've called people out, we've called them pimp, gangsters, I mean, whoever. We've been very, very, very clear on our words and how powerful they are and what they are. So I do want to welcome again to the show, Reverend Irene, and for the first time, Elwood Watson. So thank you for coming on board and spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And the other thing I want to mention is, like, I think all of us have our websites, not just a Black Commentary website, but you can go to any of our websites. And somebody like Julia Malveaux, she actually puts out a newsletter that I wouldn't have the time to do, but it's an excellent newsletter with all her stuff. And other thing that I found out almost serendipitously, David, is that when our stuff gets printed in Black Commentator, it automatically goes to LA Progressive. Mm-hmm. I did not know that when I started. And so our words go to a whole nother section of people. So I was happy about that. But let's get down to what's going on, because we are starting out February 4th, and close to the beginning of Black History Month, I really want us to reflect on all that is going on with Black history. And I know, Elwood, you actually are on a campus. So are you, Dave, right? Mm-hmm. David, talk about what's going on at the campus, particularly what's going on in the Black Studies Department. Are you having to push back, organize against some of the encroachment on your program, whether it be funding or, you know, programmatically? But what's the temperature of on the campus now around Black history and culture?
Well, at East Tennessee State University, where I'm a professor, I'm a professor of history, American history, Black studies, and gender and sexuality studies and pop culture. So at my institution, the Black population in East Tennessee has never been very large, but we do have a Black studies program. And one of my colleagues is the director of the program right now. I was the acting chair several years ago. And right now, where Tennessee is like a lot of southern states, I call them, you know, the red states, where, you know, they outlawed any type of diversity initiatives, and a lot of things have had to be reorganized or certainly at the very least redefined. And with that, there are still efforts to have celebrations on Dr. King and Martin Luther King Jr. Day and those type of things. They have not been abolished. But there are people who are using different titles and different things. So the events are still taking place, but the manner in which they're doing, the language has changed, at least at my institution. So there hasn't been any type of major upheaval or, you know, significant resistance to Black History Month or an era. The celebrations are still taking place. The breakfasts are still happening. So nothing has really, really changed dramatically in that sense. But I can imagine in more places, more locations where, you know, the populations of Blacks are larger and where race relations have always been somewhat, you know, fragmented, it's probably much more of an issue. But that's pretty much what's going on with my situation at East Tennessee State University.
I guess I'm a little bit surprised, seeing as I consider that the South, that you all would have gotten a little bit more backlash. But yeah, so David, what's going on your campus?
Can I say something quicker for that?
Sure.
We're the South, but it's Appalachia. Where I live, Memphis is the South, okay? Where I live is Appalachia. I mean, that's Northeast Tennessee. You've got to realize Northeast Tennessee was actually Union with the Union during the Civil War, the part of Tennessee I live in. It's always had a populist streak. So, is, you know, Bernie Sanders won here in 2016. So what I'm saying is, yeah, it's conservative, but it's not that traditional Deep South conservatism. So to let you know, that would be that's pretty much always been the hallmark of this area. That's why it was called the Volunteer State during that time, because Upper East Tennessee was Union during the Civil War, and it has strong Union sentiment, you know, as well.
Thank you for that Black history. See, we teach Black history. Yes, there you go, right there. We got a history lesson. Thank you for that, Professor.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
Okay, David, what's going on your campus? And the whole notion of DEI is, you know, pretty much dead. What about where you are?
Well, you know, so I'm at Rutgers, and Rutgers is in New Jersey. So, you know, one could say that, you know, we are in somewhat safer territory. However, at the same time, you know, we are not immune to what's going on in the greater society. I'm in the Journalism and Media Studies department, and I tend to teach a lot of courses on issues of race, gender, sexuality, and also ethics. And, you know, there's no sense that any of that is under threat, which is good, because I wouldn't have anything to teach. But at the same time, the administration is eliminating DEI. Also, we have a Black president. But in any case, that's interesting. But in any case, you know, we have to ask ourselves, I think, and I'm asking myself, how do we navigate this terrain and maintain our principles and our integrity? I understand, you know, and I see what's going on in campuses across the country. And, you know, ultimately, I feel that these institutions who are capitulating to white supremacists and fascists, what they're going to learn eventually is that there is nothing you can do to satisfy them, because they will not be satisfied until all of us are gone. So I'm trying to look in terms of, and when I say gone, I mean really gone, physically gone. One of my colleagues, Mark Bray, professor in the history department, he received death threats because Turning Point USA placed his name on a hit list of professors who were Antifa and therefore terrorists, because Trump says that, you know, Antifa people who study anti-fascism are terrorists. So he had to flee the country, and he is now in Spain with his family, teaching courses online because he didn't want to get killed. And I think that really pinpoints, you know, the problems that we're facing now in terms of academic freedom. And I'm trying to look in terms of getting beyond all of this. I think it's going to be a long struggle, but I will say that I'm vigilant and I'm not backing down, and I'm not you know, stopping what I'm doing or changing the way I teach. I don't mince words, and I think now, you know, now is the time where we have to show people what we're all about.
And Reverend Irene, I know that you aren't necessarily on the campus as a professor, but you certainly get invited to speak as I do. And I'm wondering, in these last couple of years, has that changed? Has the invitations to come on campus changed? Because a lot of times we don't know the dynamics around there, like we're like somebody's debating whether or not to invite a Jamala Rogers to their campus. We may not hear about that, but you may not get invited, but you didn't know that. And so has anything changed for you, or have you gotten any backlash, particularly based on, the gender vendor stuff? I mean, these folks are going after anybody and everybody for all kinds of frivolous reasons. And so I know there's been some concern about, safety of folks like us, who go onto these campuses, and speaking truth to power. What's been your experience?
Well, first of all, I'm glad to say that I'm a retired professor, okay? No longer teaching at Harvard, which I call, in high cotton, the big plantation here, because I do feel like if I were there today, that they certainly would have shown me the exit door here. I'm still getting speaking engagements, to my surprise. And one of the things I think about that, particularly in a time of, erasure that we're seeing, but I think a lot of folks understand this, that first, as Black people, we don't need the president to give us the okay to celebrate us and our accomplishments and to share it with other people, because we've been doing it for 100 years. This month marks the 100th anniversary of Black History Month. And it's quite pivotal because we're on the eve of America's 250th anniversary. So to know that this has survived in the face of, and this is interesting, in the face of what I understand, 250 years of slavery, 90 years of Jim Crow, and 60 years of separate and unequal discrimination against us. That in and of itself to me is miraculous. I love the fact that we are celebrating Black History Month, and I'm elated that I'm going to universities. And I have even said this here, to folks here, that don't call me on Black History Month because it's High Black Employment Month for the Rev. But given the country's, revisionist history, Black history is challenging selective memory and the deliberate attempt to erase us. I mean, just this year, there'll be no Black History month program scheduled at Trump's, I need to say, Kennedy Center. But this didn't just happen. I mean, I remember in 2025, part of Trump's renewal campaign to dismantle DEI, what he did was that he made sure that you remove any all websites, if you remember, honoring Jackie Robinson's service, if I, in the army. And I was glad that that was a public outcry. And then, the governor of Florida, DeSantis, in 2023, he started banning books, including the illustrious works of Harvard professor and PBS host of Finding Your Roots, Henry Louis Gates. So, I'm glad that I'm invited. But I'm also glad that, there are folks who understand that Black History Month is American history. It wouldn't be where it is, okay, were it not for the history. And I appreciate our tenacity, 100 years of it. Thank God for Dr. Carter Woodson, who give us this history, because we understand this, that we have to write ourselves into history. That's important here. We need to celebrate ourselves, and that by having Black History Month, we are our archive of we're maintaining an archive of history, and we're providing a survival, a canon of survival for future generations.
And that's absolutely true. And I think a lot about this in the last couple of years, because people keep telling me, particularly my elders, is that you got to keep talking and you have to keep adding content to the internet, because if we don't like continue to talk and write, there will be no record of what's going on. And then, I think all of us take what we do seriously, but then I added another sort of responsibility and even a burden about what it means to document these times. And so I think that, I just had a talk to a group about Black history, and sometimes I start off by saying, Dr. Carter G. Woodson picked that month and picked the week. Because sometimes I hear Black people saying, white folks, the power structure gave us the shortest month of the year. That's not fair. And I have to remind people, this is part of knowing your history. Like Dr. Carter G. Woodson picked that because his idols were, Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. Their birthdays were there, so he picked that. But over the next 50 years, Black folks said, this is such a robust body of work. It's going to take more than a week for us to get to this. So then it became Black History Month.
That's right.
Now, if you look at any of the memes out there, they say 365 days, and that's real. So I think, the 100 years, it took us a while to get here. But Black History Month, as you said, Irene, is so important because it is American history. And to the degree that that's suppressed, repressed, revised, then revises the whole history of this country. And so I think it's just critically important that we maintain it and we help other institutions. Like, I don't know what to do about the National African American History Museum, who's having to placate to Trump. I mean, I feel bad for them, but that's not while I'm a member of, I'm not trying to give y'all money to do that. My little dollars, I want them to count. And so I know that they are in a very precarious position. I don't know how we help support them, but I guess you continue to send money and say, if you need any help around trying to keep that dog at bay, let me know. But what do we do about those kinds of institutions? We saw in Philly where they started taking down different monuments on the street. It's just like we're seeing it in so many different ways that we've taken for granted. Like, we have a visual wall where it says, this is Black, the history of, and then all of a sudden it's gone. Well, in another 5, 10 years, folks won't even remember what was there. How do we protect these Black institutions that are preserving, protecting our history?
Well, I just want to say this quickly. We've always found ways to maintain our history whether I could tell people black media long before the New York Times and well, I grew up in New York City before the New York Times and Washington Post here. One of the ways we've always done it, whether I call it, whether it's the Chitlin Circuit, the oral history, black Twitter, the grapevine. But I think one of the things that we have to understand when we talk about black Smithsonian, and that's the museum in DC, that's government money, and that we need to own some of these buildings, so that becomes the problem when the city and the government give you a building. You can always expect that it might at any time, when the tide turn, to take it away here. So we got to own it like we own our black churches here, and that's the only way in which we can maintain the artifacts of our history.
So the two folks that are actually on campus, are there any particular cultural institutions that are maybe separate from even those departments that you think are at risk, or even in the communities where you are, that people need to be aware of?
Not so much where I'm at. I think that I do want to go back about, as we were talking about Black History Month. That is my next column for BC Black Commentator, so you'll see that tomorrow.
That's mine too. See, that's how we double up.
So there's Reverend Irene Moreau as well. There you go. So, but I think that but I think that I'm looking forward to seeing your perspective on it. And I feel. You mentioned a very good point, Jamala, about the organizations with the Smithsonian and others. The NAACP has been running a lot of commercials lately on television. I don't know if you've been seeing those lately about needing donations of money. I have to be honest, and this might get some people upset, listeners and others, but I'm not willing to donate to the NAACP right now because I really don't see, and not just them, but other organizations, I haven't really seen that level of pushback or that level of resistance that you saw decades ago for Black leadership. And to me, I feel right now is you simply cannot just ask for money and we need your help now if that, I don't if you're not seeing any at least if I'm not seeing any efforts to respond to the attacks on Black history and Black institutions. And it's not even there. I think if you look at a lot of areas of the Black community right now, the silence among even, I'm not talking about the current minister here, Barreau, others, but I mean the silence among the Black clergy, the silence among the Black politicians and others, it's almost been kind of deafening. And I really have not seen any response or resistance. And I'm saying, I don't think people are saying, I really cannot support. If you're going to be a leader and you're supposed to be speaking on behalf of the community, and that's what you're saying you're representing, then I have to see more demonstrative action. And I think a lot of it has been performative at best. And I just don't see any effort or awareness, and I'm not, and in good conscience myself, I cannot, and I have to see a lot more because more effort in order before I'm willing to really, go out there and really, really support. I mean, my financial support to these organizations.
Right. No, I hear you. What about you, David? What's going on that way?
So as I said, I'm at Rutgers and I also live in Philadelphia. So I have two different perspectives on this. I mean, as far as Rutgers, I don't see any threats to, as far as eliminating Black expression on campus. I mean, we have the Paul Robeson Cultural Center. Paul Robeson is, our most famous alum. And I think all hell would break loose if they tried to do something to eliminate his name from the campus. I would say also, looking at Philadelphia, we are now witnessing the of course, as was just mentioned, the monuments to Black folks being removed from the National Park Service structure, the original White House, the presidential mansion where Washington lived and enslaved people. We also have to realize that this is the 50th anniversary of the African American Museum in of Philadelphia. And I think that, institutions like that have to be maintained and supported. I think it's crucial. Also, the 20th anniversary of African American studies being required study in Philadelphia public schools. My son, thankfully, has to learn that. He's learning it at home anyway, but the fact that all students have to learn it, I think, is crucial. And we have to, we have to make sure that that continues. And as far as what Elwood said about some of these institutions, that Black institutions that aren't really doing much, I think that we have to look at some of these legacy institutions that maybe have been able to sustain themselves from their historical reputation, but haven't done much lately, and maybe start to look at newer organizations that are really out there doing what has to be done. I think of, Black Voters Matter and other organizations that maybe are more in tune with the needs of today. And maybe we have to look at some of those organizations to help us to maintain this legacy, because there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you say required reading, this is sad, but I immediately thought about the Orange Man has mandated the viewing of Melania as historical, whatever, whatever. He's mandating that this be required. I mean, so it's such a sad commentary of where we are in this country. But I think to you all's point, it means even more work for us to do, because if he's going to be pushing that garbage, then what is that not going to have us pushing forward? And so I think we just have to be more resolute in our determination that, we here, we're going to stay, you're going to respect us, you're going to respect our legacy, you're going to respect our history, and you're not going to whitewash it like you've been doing Dr. King's. So I look forward to reading you all's two pieces on, well, we did, me, I think me and somebody else here did something on King last time, but we've been managing every year to like reclaim his legacy, whether it be on the King birthday or closer to his assassination
I did King
anniversary.
last
But
month. I did a King, that was a piece on King I did last month. So, yeah.
okay, yeah, definitely. So and Elwood, you talked about these institutions, but I really want us to talk about the Democratic Party.
Sure.
Like these folks, some of where we are now, they have to take some responsibility for, and some of these elected officials, in terms of, first of all, not even understanding the gravity of a Trump ascendancy to the throne. And so, there's such a disgust with them right now by even the folks who have to vote for them, because again, because we only a two-party system, basically a two-party system, it's Tweedledee, Tweedledum. But I think people get tired of that, and sometimes we're voting with our feet by not going to the polls. But I want to play something from a podcaster last week that I think may speak to some of the concern that we have for what's going on now with the Democrats. So hold on here. I'm gonna see if I can get it up.
Okay.
So that was the Lance Pod Land. I forgot, Urban Pod. But really, when I heard that, I'm like, I've heard that from a number of different sources about they're not really opposing what's going on. They're really just trying to wait their turn so they can get some of that power. So I just want to, what's your response to that?
That for me, I would say, yeah, I think that to me, one of the reasons I'm a registered independent is that because I don't have much, I have problems with both the Democratic and the Republican Party. I think both parties, to me, at the end of the day, outside of maybe a few issues like abortion, reproductive rights, there's not really that much difference in either one. I mean, both are in the pockets of Wall Street, both are in the pockets of corporate America, and
APAC.
AIPAC. I mean, those are, I'm about saying to me, that's just to me, there's not really, but you said Tweedledee and Tweedledum, that's pretty much about right. And I think that that's where I think we need, I've always said for several years now, we need at least four or five viable parties in the United States, because we've had them in the past. And until that happens, I don't see the people as the people they're supposed to speak for. being benefited at all, because as far as I'm concerned, we're way down on the list of their concerns if we're on the list at all. Okay, so I think that it's about, appeasing corporate donors, wealthy billionaires, lobbyists, lawyers. I mean, they're all working, for corporate and the politicians right now. There's no polite way to say it. Many are bought and paid for,
Right.
and
Yeah.
that's a and I mean they're but they're bought and paid for. I mean, with corporate, exactly, when people are giving you $40 million to a campaign and whatever, they're not, most for the most part, they're not doing it out of the kindness of their heart. I mean, they're doing it because they're expecting something from you, okay? And the reality
Right.
is, and that's what's happening, there's too much money in politics right now. And the Supreme Court, Citizens United, and how it was terrible, and the law, I mean, that was one of the worst decisions that could be made, because it gave unlimited amounts of money you could donate to corporate campaigns. It used to be a limit for anybody, and that was done by design years ago, because it kept, money out. It kept the millionaires from ever being able to exercise that level of control over the political system. And now what is happening is, because of that law that's passed, the corporations and plutocrats and others are basically buying politicians and enacting their own agenda. And I mean, I'm not convinced that's even just Republican conservative. I would even say there are neoliberals and others who are involved in that dynamic. I mean, we talk about, the conservatives, but I'm not convinced that some liberals, you listen to people like James Carville, talk about wokeness on college campuses, and he attacked Jasmine Crockett, talking about she was, I mean, he is, that man is basically Republican light at a minimum. I mean, that man, I mean, he is not. I mean, he is not. I mean, that man is. I mean, he's a centrist Democrat. I mean, he is definitely not no progressive Democrat. I mean, you might as well just put him over. Well, his wife, he married Mary Matlin, who was Bush's campaign manager in 1992, George Bush's senior's campaign manager in 1992, Mary Matlin. So my point is that right there, it tells you, I mean, how a lot of, how interwoven these a lot of these people are, pretty much are. I mean, they're some of their, some of them have, Monica Crowley, who wrote Nixon the Winner. She was on Fox for a while, a commentator. Alan, the late Alan Combs, he's a liberal podcaster or whatever. She was his sister-in-law. I mean, so I'm saying, I mean, people marry who they love, but my point is, a lot of times these people go to clutch country clubs together, and
That's right.
they pretty much, they're just the same churches and everything else. I mean, they get along a lot better than they than publicly they might go all yell and scream and stuff. I mean, when somebody was telling a joke, they said, for all we know, that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Alcee Hastings might be buddies, and I'm just I mean, it's just like, so I think those kind of things. I mean, they Aaron Magruder, it's after, he did that show called, he did a comic called The Boondocks years ago.
That's right,
He was like, he remember he had that episode, and they were arguing in the green room on TV and stuff. And at the very end of it, they were in the room with each other, like, yeah, oh hey, how you doing? How you doing? Good to see you again. And this is good for our paychecks. And after that, that was the last episode he did. That you haven't heard it from him a lot, because I think he exposed a secret that they didn't want you to know about. They were saying,
right. I agree with you.
You know what I'm saying? He all of a sudden he was no, you know, he was like, well, I think I'm going to move away from this for a while. I think he was probably pressured or bullied. He might have got a severance package, but he was basically, he exposed something that they did not want you to see. I mean, they get on arguing TV with each other stuff, but at the end of the day, they're all getting paid. Okay.
I agree. I so agree
By
with
the same
you.
people.
Yes.
Yes.
I so agree with you. One of the
Thank you.
things that has always been a query for me is that when they talked about reaching over the aisle, and I always go like, now, and I look at that from this, I look at this from this position. You got Republicans and Democrats here and stuff. And when I said reaching across the aisle, it's like how much I read it as how much can we maintain our power and privilege and look like we're giving people, what they want. And so I always have thought that there wasn't much difference between both parties. I stayed with the Democratic Party because, again, I think I shared on the previous show that my councilwoman was Shirley Chisholm, and one of her books was Unbossed and One Bo Unbought. So you can understand why she only could excel, but so far, within any machine here. But I do think that they're in cahoots with each other. But I do need to say this, that the Republican Party, I need to say the Democratic Party has no game. That's number one. And what we don't look at is that Republican Party, and it was before, Proposition 2025, have a long game because we have really seen the diminishment of civil rights us, really since Ronald Reagan here. I mean, when you look at affirmative action, we got affirmative action in 1965, but effectively lands in 2023, right? You would agree with me
Right.
with that. Then we get DEI. I mean, we would say effectively it hits the public around 2020, but we can definitely say 2025 is gone, is way gone, right? And so when I think about this, is that this is nothing new. When I look at Reconstruction era, right, we would say that it began in 1865, right, the end of the Civil War, but clearly by 1877, it's gone. So my point is, why are we as a people, the history has shown us that even in that moment, it looks like it's turning the dial. It will only turn it as much as it doesn't have to lose both parties. It's power and privilege. And when they said the Browning of America, we could have never thought that that transition would be easy. And when and also when I say we have no game, because we're still looking at a paradigm that derived and rightly so and effectively so out of the 1960s, a paradigm that is absolutely defunct now. And so I agree with you, Elwood, about the NAACP. They really do have to up their game.
Yeah. So, there's all this hoopla around the midterm elections, like something magical is going to happen should the Democrats get control again. So David, what should we be looking at as we go into that? Because it seems to me that we are making more demands out of the Republicans, but sort of letting the Democrats slide. And I've been so disappointed, even when they tried that thing last time about shutting down the house, blah blah blah. They would, the Democrats wouldn't hear it in other cities, and then they, they relinquished. I'm like, what was all that for? Really?
Yes.
What do we get out of that? Nada. And so I think poor people and working people, multiracial working class, they are just tired of being pitted in this ping pong game of who's going to do something for us. And I know people got mad that some of our folks defected and voted for Trump, but it's either one or the other. So you say, I'm gonna take a chance with this guy. Why? History showed us that that's not the guy. But what should we be thinking about as we get to these midterms and all this energy around, let's get
Just
the
one quick thing, if you don't mind, before David, I'm sorry. Did you anybody hear about Farrakhan, what he was saying yesterday or the day before?
No.
Yeah, I think it's on YouTube, whatever. He's talking about, he was actually supporting, he thought Trump was good for black folks. I mean, you all have to go see it for yourself, but I was like, and I've always been leery of Louis Farrakhan anyway, but I'm just saying I've never been a big fan. But sorry, David, go ahead. But
Oh, that's okay. No, that was worth hearing. I agree with everything everybody has said about this issue. I mean, I'll start off by saying that I think we have to tell the Democrats either you're going to change or we are going to replace you. They are acting like controlled opposition. And I'm speaking as the former director of the Pennsylvania Legislative Black Caucus. When folks are getting money from Palantir, from AIPAC, from all of these corporate interests, billionaires, they're not going to act in the interests of the people. So they're going to have to decide what are we doing here? I think ultimately, yeah, we need to challenge these people. We have to run people to replace them. We have to look at other parties. I know in Philadelphia and other cities, you have the Working Families Party, and other independent parties. We have to build those institutions because the Democrats are not going to do it in their present form. I have no vested interest in Democrats
Well,
or
David,
Republicans.
if we see somebody that's progressive, that's principled, and we want to elect them, what happens when they go into the swamp? And I'm thinking about the pressure that the Justice Democrats got from the establishment, people like AOC. I mean, they weren't welcome. It's like, okay, they're a threat, and they probably could have helped to push, these centrists and even some backward folks in the right direction. Now, we just had the guy from Texas win. This was a union person, a working class person. What does it mean for him to go into the swamp?
Well, ultimately, the swamp has to be drained. But I mean, in reality, not all that stuff that Trump was talking about. We have to get money out of politics. Simple as that. We have to get money out of politics. We have an oligarchy, we have a kleptocracy,
Yes.
a handful of billionaires, one of them soon to be trillionaire, controlling all the cards. And until we change that, I don't see
And
how.
how do we change it, David? Because I'm thinking there have been times when somebody ran who had hardly any money, but they had a good organization, they had a good platform, and they won. And so I always use those examples, like it's not always all about the money. You have to have a decent platform that, resonates with people. And but that doesn't seem to be enough, because it's just it, I mean, you get these record-breaking races where like tens of millions of dollars are being spent. Who can compete with that?
I think the newly elected mayor of New York City shows you an example of what that's like. I also think Bernie Sanders sort of, shows us that, as well as AOC. And they're speaking to a larger demographic across all kinds of, vectors here, all kinds of social indicators of what the masses of the people want. And so it's not that it can be done. But we timing is everything, and we have to have the right person to come forth. But a lot of people do this for their own self, aggrandizement. I can't believe it's about the pay, but it does give you a lot of perks here and stuff. So I mean, we got to go through the weeds here and find folks who really want to affect a change and get behind those people here. And when we do those things, because I mean, when we look at the mayor of New York, he's a Muslim. Okay, unabashedly so, unapologetically so. That is not the face of what we would expect here. So I think that in some ways, sometimes that person has that be the person who's very much in the margin that comes with such a compelling message that we all get on board. We saw that with, Barack Obama. Because at one time I was saying I thought it was Leroy Jones, his African name. I was saying Bar I couldn't remember, but I was using his name, thinking, oh my God, is the poet now gonna be president? Okay, that's right. That's right. I kept saying thank you. I kept saying that. Yeah. So I think that that's what we got to understand, and it's really in the hands of a future generation of folks. I think that the mayor of New York, I think he's a millennial. I'm not sure. Or he might be Gen X or something, but we actually need younger folks who are not afraid either, and don't feel they have a lot to lose.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
And
I
I just
keep
like.
thinking about, go ahead. I'll keep thinking about the new mayor and likening him to Cuba. When you get isolated, you can't do your agenda. And one of the fears I have for Madami is that they're going to start roadblocks in his way. And then people will say, see, I told you. And so how do we make sure that the Democrats that we ask them to put their lives on the line at this point, because they're killing Democrats. Like they're killing Democrats, with they don't agree with them. So this is some serious business, because none of us, well, when people ask me why don't I run, I do better on the outside than the inside. But we don't have a bench of those people that you're talking about, Reverend Irene, that could come forward. And then what happens is, like, when there's an opportunity, opportunists come forward. And so how do we prepare for that? And how do we start identifying some younger people who are unapologetically not tied to the system, but who want transformational change?
Well, I think you see Summer Lee in Pennsylvania is a good example of that too. I mean, who doesn't take money? I'm sure Dave is more familiar with her since he lives in Pennsylvania in the area. But I'd also say too, as a historian, I studied trends. There are a lot of things that were happening in the 1850s that are happening now in the United States. Talk of secession and resistance toward government. And as it was Mark Twain who said it best: history doesn't exactly repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I think we're in a Civil War right now. I think we're in a Civil War right now. And it's not like a war between the states like we did in the 19th century, but we're in a culture wars and we're in a lot of those dynamics. And I think you're going to see a reconstruction probably in the next 4 or 5 years, within this country, probably even 3 to 4 years right now. I think I'm more optimistic. I think we'll get through this. America's going through rough times, and a lot of times, whatever it is that people don't understand, but sometimes it's what you least expect that sets the mass people off. You remember in 1773, people were like, wait a minute, you all upset about tea, the Boston Tea Party? You remember what they said? Taxation, no taxation
We'll
without.
show you.
No taxation without representation, and you live in Massachusetts, Dr. Irene, so you know what I'm talking
That's
about. But it was,
right.
but I said, but it was saying, no taxation without representation, and I mean that led to the American Revolution, and so I think there's always something that before that people least expect, and I think you're beginning to see that now with some Republicans who are beginning to defect, and people are hostile toward Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, she wasn't my ideal person, but she, I think she genuinely sincere about the Epstein files, and I think she was genuinely sincere about not getting involved in a lot of international, I think her constituents, not getting involved in a lot of international conflicts, and there are a lot of conservatives who are like that, and there are Democrats and Republicans saying, look, stop funding these international wars. We need money back here in the United States, the unnecessary wars that are basically just helping contractors and lining people's pockets here in the United States, and lose American young men are losing lives of people at the expense of, because somebody, wants to line their pockets. Democrats and Republicans, the military industrial complex, we got people, politicians in both parties who are making hundreds of millions of dollars off that. They told the Pentagon several years ago, the Pentagon said, we don't need any more weapons. They said, well, you're getting them anyway. I mean, to me, that just goes to show
Right.
you.
And they're on our streets now.
There
Okay.
you go.
Right. The
Yeah.
surplus of
1033.
that is on our streets. And
Right.
we saw that with, with Michael Brown. And
Yes.
they just continue to get worse and worse to the point here. You do wonder when you look at ICE, you say, oh my God. Who is he? You have to protect yourself from them.
Right,
A
exactly.
town of 25, 30,000 people with a militarized police force. That is ridiculous. I mean,
Exactly.
what is a town with 25? Even Jake Tapper himself, at that time, I guess he was supposed to be objective, and he was in Ferguson or something during that time. He goes, this is ridiculous. This is unnecessary. And I think that he called himself because it was like he himself saw how crazy that was, what they were doing. I
But see,
mean,
the turning point that might have some sustainability is the two last killings of people with Renee Good and then Alex Petrie.
right.
And the reason for that, because again, we're in Minnesota again. We had George Floyd. And we were asking at that time for the anti-lynching bill. We were hoping that when, oh gosh, I can't think of his name here, but Good Trouble, Senator
Lewis,
John,
John
okay.
Lewis.
John Lewis, okay, we were hoping that before he died, he would see the passing of that bill. We still, George Floyd died. We still didn't give it, we still didn't get it. So but eventually we did, but this is long past the issues here.
And it
And
was a watered-down version.
oh, thank you.
Yes.
Okay, it dishonored John Conyers, who was very much an advocate back in the 70s around it. But what I'm saying is that the optics now look like white America. That boy that was killed, Alex, he looked like, okay, we all know that kind of dude. We all have seen that dude, in our neighborhood. So when it looks like us and it's not brown and black bodies, it's a serious wake-up call.
Well, I said
Yeah.
myself, the Trump administration, their agenda to me, as far as I see it, it doesn't matter if you're what color, even if you're white, if you're black, white, if even you could be a heterosexual white male, if you're not on board with their agenda, you are the enemy. Okay, they
Right.
don't
Yeah.
care who you are. Alex Petley is a good example. They are people. I said it's not just about people of color; it's about white people. Whereas Renee Good, whatever. If you're not on board with them, you could be a heterosexual white person as well. You are the enemy. They want you, either you're with us or you're not. They don't care. It's about their nationalist authoritarian agenda. And that means if you're white, not with us, you're the enemy. They don't care who you
Yeah.
are. That's
Yeah.
anybody. That's
And that's been a wake-up call for white America. Because it's like, whoa,
absolutely.
whoa, whoa, what happened? What just happened here? Two white people got killed? Yeah.
That's right. And
Brutally
I think
killed. I
what
mean,
people are learning now is that supremacy will kill white folks.
Always
Which
will.
have, always have.
All
Yes.
In fact, sometimes the venom is worse toward white people because they see them as being traitors.
That's right.
Exactly.
Turncoats. That's right.
Race
Yes. Or
traitors.
race
Race
traitor. There you
traitors.
go.
Right.
That's
Yeah,
right.
exactly. And I'm exactly. Look at John Brown was a good example of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, but that's, I think a lot of people don't seem to understand. I'm saying that is the case. Now, I mean, if you're white and you're not on their side, they don't care. You're still the enemy. I mean, that's, I mean,
See, but
not
my
the,
concern, though, is this, though. While we're asking, what do we do next? We got to get these white folks invested in it. First of all, I'm a little leery. Will we have a midterm election? Because I'm assuming he will find a way to not have that. But the point about it is that the same constituent in the face of Trump 1.0 were the same constituents, for Trump 2.0. And I need to say this about white women. But white people in general, they will vote against their interests. But I thought particularly white women, it would be a somewhat turn, given that we have there have been some that look Roe v. Wade. Okay, Roe v. Wade here. So that is the stuff that gets me, that once you can get that mindset change, there really won't be any change.
well, what is happening
Right.
is too, well, I'm sorry, what is happening, I think that this election, this past election in last November, Abigail Spanberger won by 15% in Virginia, and Mickey Sherrill, you remember that was supposed to be a close race in New Jersey, she won by 15 points. Okay, that is not close. Okay, just here in Texas recently, the guy won in a district that Trump won by 20 some points, won by 15, 16 points again there. So my point is, I'm saying a lot of women are realizing now, they realize a lot of these white men are saying, they're coming out saying women need to be trad wise, women don't need to vote. Coming out and literally saying it publicly. Years ago they would have kept that quiet, but like saying women don't need to vote. I don't think my wife should have a right to vote. T saying their own wives should not have a right to vote. Now they're coming out saying that. I mean, they're coming out saying that literally. So I mean, these are supposed to be Christian pastors and things like that as well. So my point is that is showing you a lot of women are saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. I think they realize, look, they want you back in the bear. They, as far as I'm concerned, they have that 19th century verse.
Barefoot and pregnant.
Barefoot and pregnant, exactly. Barefoot and pregnant, and have my meals ready when I get home, and my slippers, my martini, and my martini. That's what a lot of those men. That's the mindset they're in. Okay,
Father knows best, and Donna Reed shows.
there you go. There you
Yeah,
go.
yeah, yeah.
And I think
So
as
it's
don't,
go ahead. Go ahead,
I'm sorry.
Dave.
I think as daunting as things appear, I think there's also a lot of encouragement because it seems that some people at least are waking up.
Okay.
And I think the important thing is to somehow take that and translate it into action. I think people are not going to go for the okey doke once again. We're not going to get out of our problems. We're not going to solve this by giving ICE body cams. I
No,
think
not at all.
we have to look for political leaders who will demand a restructuring of this country, economy and government. And I hope this isn't the case, but it might an economic collapse for people to finally wake up and say, hey, look, we ain't going through this again.
So my concern always is like what happens? People are ready, and I'm talking about the multiracial working class. Like, we have not done the kind of organizing and education that we need to have done to for any of these catastrophes, whether they be a culture war, economic collapse, the austerity that comes with that, or a military war that completely like folks, communities are occupied. And so I think we got a lot to do on our end. They're doing their due. I mean, those folks got their plan and they gone with it. So again, I wanted to thank all of y'all. This has been Black Commentary Wednesday, the round table, and we have had a hell of a discussion, but we didn't even get to all of our topics. So that's how serious this stuff is. And but we're gonna do okay. It's Black History Month. I wanted to remind you all that there is a lot going on. We talk, just go to my website and see some of the things that are going on with Black History Month. But it's the month that we need to know about ourselves, to protect ourselves and connect with ourselves, because if we don't do it, nobody else will. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and I will see you on the battlefield. Thank you for listening.
Amen.
Right now, right now, right now.
We don't need